Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Je m'appelle Colleen Shepherd, je suis directrice du Centre sur les droits de la personne et le pluralisme juridique. C'est un grand honneur de vous accueillir ici à l'Université de McGill et à Montréal ce soir. Hello, my name is Colleen Shepherd. I'm the director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, and it's my great honor to welcome you here to the University of McGill and to Montreal. I'm also chairing, I have the great honor to chair, to be the chair of the Eckenberg Global Conference on Human Rights, Democracy, and the Fragility of Freedom. And I will be the moderator for this afternoon's opening plenary. I want to begin by thanking all of you who have traveled from countries near and far to join us for this historic event on this second day of spring. Springtime has been an important metaphor for movements for social and political change. And as we welcome spring in a city blanketed by snow, we are reminded of the challenges, obstacles, and setbacks to social movements for democracy and social justice. And indeed, the inspiration for this conference began with events surrounding the Arab Spring, as we witnessed and continue to witness thousands risking their lives in the struggle for democracy and freedom. And these historic events over the past few years reminded us of how important fundamental human rights, including civil and political freedoms, as well as economic and social rights, how important they are to democracy. The protection of human rights is an essential precursor to democracy, just as democracy is essential for the effective protection of human rights. And this connection has and continues to infuse the hopes and dreams of those seeking social change and respect for human rights across generations, continents, and history. Still, as the great Canadian jurist Thomas Berger has written, our freedoms are fragile. Human rights and freedoms need constant vigilance and active engagement to secure their continued protection. Now, although the topic for the conference, Human Rights, Democracy, and the Fragility of Freedom, is expansive, we have endeavored to put together a conference program that builds upon common themes and challenges facing diverse and emerging democracies, examining democracy through the lens of local and participatory democracy, national and state-level democracy, and the impact of transnational actors on democracy in a global and interconnected world. In tonight's session, we highlight the critical role of individuals whose agency, courage, and resilience are so essential to the promise of democracy. Tomorrow, we start the day off with a conversation that explores the conceptual and practical connections between democracy, an extended panel examining the Arab Spring, followed by a session on China, foreign policy, and economic justice. Saturday's sessions focus on the link between the protection of fundamental freedoms and democracy and the importance of ensuring inclusive democracies, that is, democracies that are welcoming of diverse, young, and emerging voices and open to new ways of engaging in democratic change. So we have a large agenda with exceptional scholars, policymakers, and activists from around the world as our panelists. But beyond the formal sessions and presentations, we look forward to the informal dialogue and discussions which will bring this conference to life. And in this regard, I also wanted to explain that in conjunction with this global conference, we have hosted a Young Leaders Forum over the past 4 days, which has brought young persons engaged in democratic and social change from around the world together to examine the challenges and questions at the intersection of human rights and democracy. Their engagement brings important energy, synergy, and expertise to this conference, and you will be hearing from them beginning this evening with our short video on what democracy means to me, which we'll be showing now actually after the featured panelists, the panel, and in the sessions throughout the conference. On a final note, I wish to take this opportunity to say some thank yous and also to make a few technical and logistical announcements. So first for the thank yous. I wish to begin by thanking my two honorary co-chairs, the Honorable Erwin Kotler, Professor Emeritus of the McGill Faculty of Law and a Member of Parliament, what better for a person for a conference on democracy, and Maître Raymond Chrétien, a partner and strategic advisor at Fasken Martineau Dumoulin, and a former Canadian ambassador for many years. They have brought tremendous knowledge and support to the organization of the conference, and I thank them for their generosity. I also wish to thank my colleague Nandini Ramanujam, the Executive and Program Director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, whose intellectual input, energy, and creative organizational magic has made this conference happen. My thanks as well to the committed and diligent work of Sharon Webb, the administrative coordinator for our center, for handling all of the logistics and bringing young leaders and speakers from around the world, as well as her work in coordinating the conference events. Also, in terms of the travel and organization, I wanted to thank Howard Liebman as well and Erwin Kotler's offices for all of their assistance in helping us with visas and travel arrangements. This conference, of course, would not have been organized without the incredibly talented and diligent team of student conference coordinators and organizers, including Corey Longridge, Megan Lee, Martha Churkow, Claire Gunner, Louise Lavine, Marianne Sandilands, Rachel Suroff, Molly Joke, and Sarah Kate Slavine and Drew Small. Thanks as well to the many volunteers who are working at the conference. Merci aussi à notre doyen, Daniel Jutras, and he'll be saying a word in a moment, for his steadfast support in ensuring the success of this conference. And finally, I wish to thank Penny and Gordon Eckenberg for committing resources and intellectual input to make possible the nurturing of a public space for engaging with the complex issues of democracy and human rights, and for the commitment to ensuring that we build a global community of young leaders. Your generosity is deeply appreciated, and your engagement infectious. Merci. We're also deeply appreciative of support from our sponsors, including the Government of Quebec. I'm very much looking forward to sharing the ideas and debates of the next 2 days. And before welcoming our principal of McGill University, I wanted to just make the logistical announcements. First, emergency and evacuation. There are 2 emergency exits in the auditorium behind the stage and 1 right outside of the auditorium. There are entrances on Sherbrooke and Mansfield in case of emergency. Centre Montréal attendant will come to assist us. I hope none of this happens. So the conference hashtag and URL are on the back of the conference name tags. Please tweet and publicize widely. And please return your name tags at the end of the conference or plenary so that we can be ecologically responsible and still know who each other is tomorrow. So I'm now, it's my great honor to welcome Heather Monroe Bloom, Principal and Vice Chancellor of McGill University, to say a few words of welcome.
There's a dramatic entrance there. Professor Shepherd, congratulations on this conference. Thank you for the opportunity to just say some opening words at the beginning of this very important conference. Bonsoir, bienvenue à tout le monde. I want to say, just to begin, special words of thanks to our wonderful co-chairs, Ramon Chrétien and the Honorable Erwin Kotler, Dean Jutras, and of course to our Center on Legal Pluralism and our Faculty of Law. Indeed, this conference on human rights diversity and the fragility of freedom comes about because of the commitment of our Faculty of Law to this important theme. But I want to thank in particular the vision of Gordon and Penny Eckenberg, who brought incredible determination to realizing a global conference that would address issues through their family foundation on global human rights. This is the 3rd conference of this series. And Gord and Penny, the fact that you have built around this conference the Leaders Forum, and welcome to our young leaders who are here. It's fantastic to have you here, and done it in tandem and collaboration with the Center and the Faculty of Law, and indeed McGill University, is so appreciated. I know you bring your heart, your soul, your funds, and your time to this important cause, and it means a great deal to you, and your commitment to it helps make us a better university. The fact that this conference is being held as a global conference at McGill also fits with McGill's international character. It's the fact that our students and our professors come from around the world, and indeed that the programs of the university reach out into all parts of the world. We're going to hear from our outstanding panelists this evening and in the course of the conference just about the challenges in other parts of the world. But for those of us who live here in North America, I think it's very important, as we do, to appreciate the fragility of human rights here at home as well. We often take democracy and human rights for granted in North America, but as we look at the huge range of human experience across the continent that we call home, we have a great call to be committed and engaged here as well as in the networks of people looking to promote human rights globally. So let me simply not stand between you and our outstanding panelists. I do want to say to our panelists, you make the conference. Without you, we wouldn't have one. That you come here so willing to share your experiences, your own learning, and to serve as examples of the courage, resilience, and determination that it takes to really overcome abuses in human rights is so deeply appreciated. So heartfelt thanks to each of you. I wish you a good conference, and to all of our participants, thank you for coming to join us.
I'd now like to ask my dean, Danielle Jutra, to please say a few words of welcome.
Bonsoir, mesdames, messieurs. Merci d'abord, Heather, d'être ici ce soir. Je sais que c'est une période très occupée pour l'université. J'apprécie énormément votre présence à cet événement pour souligner son caractère extrêmement significatif. Je voudrais peut-être dire quelques mots à partir de ma perspective de doyen de cette institution. C'est dans ce rôle qu'on me demande d'intervenir ce soir. My role as dean of the faculty, I think, involves a lot of opportunities to think about the relationship between this institution and the world that surrounds it. I encounter many occasions in which I reflect on the role of my predecessors as dean, but also the role of other academics within the Faculty of Law historically, as they were confronted with a variety of challenges in relation to democracy and human rights, and always wonder whether they thought about what I would think of them 30, 40 years from now. I also think now about what people will think of us 20, 30 years from now, and how universities perform their role within society and engage the community around them. So I look at the past, and I think about what they did. I look at the present, and like you, find many causes for concern in relation to the health of democracy and human rights around the world and in our own backyard in a number of respects. And I think about what the role of universities should be. There's been a lot of debate over the past few months in Quebec in particular about the role of higher education and the role of institutions of higher learning in engaging the community around them and being significant and relevant. Why do I say that? Well, I say that because this conference tonight is an effort to meet this responsibility of institutions of higher learning to provide safe space for critical reflection, engagement, ideas, discussions, debate on the key challenges we face as citizens of the world. I say citizens of the world to underline the fact, as Heather just mentioned, that this is a very different place from what this university was 50 years ago, or even 28 years ago when I first joined McGill as a young professor. The idea of hosting a global conference that would attract here people from around the world, activists, scholars, actors of civil society, politicians, lawyers, professors, academics, students, scholars, again, from around the world, literally, in a global conference in the strictest sense, would not have been imagined. It was beyond anybody's imagination that we could hold something this large, this complex, and this significant with so few resources. So I want to underline both the extraordinary effort that went into this, and Colleen just a moment ago thanked many people, but I want to not add to this. I want to join my voice to hers in thanking all of the people she identified, but I also want to thank Colleen herself for putting this extraordinary conference together, and thank you, the participants, the young leaders, the students, the visitors from abroad who are here to engage in that very important effort to meet the responsibility of institutions of higher learning to provide this kind of safe space for discussion, new ideas, and action on key issues that confront us as citizens of the world. Je vous souhaite une très bonne délibération. Je sais que les travaux seront importants, difficiles, qu'il y aura des conversations significatives, mais j'espère qu'il restera de tout ça dans votre cœur, dans vos têtes, quand vous repartirez chez vous, le sentiment d'avoir participé à quelque chose de très important, quelque chose qui est le fruit, je pense, de la vision de Gordon et Penny Eckenberg, qui se manifeste pour la troisième fois. Et sans plus attendre, peut-être, Colleen, je vous inviterai à revenir au podium pour présenter Gordon Eckenberg, qui vient de dire quelques mots. Merci à tous.
Merci, Dean Jutra. Yes, now I'd please ask Gordon Eckenberg of the Penny and Gordon Eckenberg Family Foundation and founder of the conference, Eckenberg Global Conference Series on Human Rights, to come and say a few words of welcome. You'll find that the bios of all of the presenters and of the Eckenbergs are also in the conference program. So please, Gordon, join us for say a few words.
Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Je vous souhaite une chaleureuse bienvenue. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and a special welcome to the speakers and the panelists from around the world, and as well to the 24 young leaders from 21 countries who participated in the International Young Leaders Forum. And as an aside, it might be of interest to the audience to know that the 24 young leaders were selected from over 400 applicants from 67 countries. And as the young leadership grows, we now have 84 young leaders from 49 countries. The advantage of speaking last in the introductions is you don't have to go through the same thank yous that everybody else has. My thank yous appear in the program. Working with the university is not always the easiest thing to do if you come from the outside. And anyone who is in this audience who's tried to do that knows what I'm talking about. I want to thank those in the faculty who've made it very easy and very encouraging. And I'm not going to single out everybody because those have been thanked, but particularly Dean Nicholas Kassir, now Judge Nicholas Kassir, Dean Jutra, and Nandini are the people with whom I have worked the longest over the prolonged period of time. And you have our thanks. It is one thing to found something. It's another thing to put it into execution. Mine will not be a few words, Colleen, and that shouldn't surprise you. But this conference series is based on the fundamental belief that human rights are not and should not be thought of as theories. For human rights to have meaning, they must be real, they must produce tangible results, they must be constantly and consistently applied at both the domestic level as well as the international level. They must be an integral part of domestic law as well as international law. They should be important building blocks, if not one of the cornerstones of foreign policy. And I, as a Canadian, strongly believe that human rights should be an essential ingredient in the formation of Canadian foreign policy. Human rights have to be more than principles on paper, lest we forget that human rights affect us all. We often forget how we, the citizens, are directly affected by human rights policies. In the end, they are the fundamental building blocks on which we base our relationships with both our fellow citizens as well as the state. They are the invisible grease that permits us to live our daily lives in comfort and without fear. And they allow us to enjoy the very freedoms that we in countries like Canada all too often take for granted. We on Main Street must be the soldiers in the fight for the advancement and preservation of human rights, both here and elsewhere. This conference and its topic is largely about change. The army fighting for change, amongst others, includes the marginalized, the impoverished, and the oppressed. But some of the highest-ranking officers in this army are today's youth. The weapons they use are not guns, bullets, or bats, but rather ideas, principles, and today's ever-changing and ever-improving technologies and social media. Because their arsenal is not limited by borders, because they encourage critical and constructive comment, they are able to generate external and, on occasional, global support for their actions, as you did, Oscar. These efforts are often and unfortunately opposed by those who refuse to change or share power. These are characteristics of despots who are likely to be my age, or regimes that have been entrenched in their positions of power for many years. Human rights will not change overnight. It will be a slow and difficult process. It will often be confrontational in nature, but one cannot shrink from controversy. To face realities, accommodations will have to be made, but such accommodations should not be made by compromising fundamental human rights principles. And that's a tall order. It's idealistic, and it cannot be equally easily accomplished. It is also likely never to be completely accomplished. Differences will always exist, but they must be acknowledged and respected. That said, and this is a major point for me, eliminating political correctness, double standards, selective facts, and a lack of context for those facts, as well as exposing biased and sometimes inflammatory opinions, are important prerequisites to progress. Sadly, however, those are also often the very shortcomings and the tactics employed by biased academics, vocal NGOs, politicians, governments, as well as international organizations and agencies. When they advance their favorite human rights cause, they wrap their warped arguments in the garments of human rights clothing. Why? To gain credibility in search of acceptance. And they do that, they bellow their assertions from any rooftop or platform that they can find. They must be brought to account if we are to have progress. More often than not, those supposed expressions of piousness are only a reflection of short-sightedness, their prejudices, political ambitions, and nothing more than an expression of political expediency. These are not acts of leadership, nor are they moral. And the most prominent and notorious offender is probably the United Nations Human Rights Council. That's precisely why, in conjunction with this conference, Penny and I founded her idea, the International Young Leaders Forum. The participants leave McGill as McGill Eckenberg Fellows. They have a potentially important role to play. They are today's hope, and tomorrow's future. I urge you to seek them out, meet them, talk to them, engage them. They are an amazing group of people. After you've done that, you will understand Penny's and my enthusiastic conviction that people like them, supported and encouraged by people like you, can make a difference. These fellows and our fellowship have the potential to be among the players who will carry the human rights ball down the field and closer to that elusive finish line. When they do that, it will be the benefit of all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Gordon. I'd like to ask my honorary co-chair, Erwin Kotler, to say words of welcome, and if he can join us at the podium. And then we'll be moving into the next part of our program.
Thank you, Colleen, and thank you for the work of yourself and the committee and the group in the McGill Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism at the Faculty of Law for all your effort with respect to convening this conference. Et bienvenue tout le monde. C'est un honneur pour moi d'être parmi vous et d'être parmi les invités distingués. I'm delighted to join my colleagues and welcome you to Montreal, and in particular, welcome you to the Faculty of Law at McGill, which had been my intellectual home, my advocacy home, for some 40 years as both a student and then as a professor. Comme je dis, j'étais étudiant et professeur à la Faculté de droit pendant 40 ans. An institution that has been home to such human rights giants as the late Dean Professor Maxwell Cohn, an inspiration in the world of international human rights law. Dean F.R. Scott, who championed la primauté des droits, the importance of the rule of law. Professor John Humphrey, the inspiration for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, along with René Cassin. And my good friend and fellow student at the time when we were at McGill, Gordon Eckenberg, whom you heard his words of inspiring expression today, who together with his family envisaged and brought to fruition these global conferences that we are sharing and are engaged in here. And I would be remiss also if I did not mention my former student, Howard Liebman, now my chief of staff. It was his unique diplomatic skills that facilitated a not insignificant number of you getting your visas and being able to be present in this conference. So thank you, Howard. This conference takes place at a transformative, indeed I would say revolutionary moment in human history. For we are witnessing the struggle for freedom, democracy, human rights, and the rule of law amidst a persistent and pervasive assault on these foundational values. In particular, we have seen the emergence of courageous voices for freedom, amplified by the social media, and widespread suppression and silencing of these voices, let alone their imprisonment. And the conference offers us a unique opportunity to engage with these human rights heroes. Indeed, the opening plenary, which we will have shortly this evening, appropriately titled Democracy and Human Rights: Stories of Engagement and Resilience, will feature a diverse chorus of inspired voices who've put not only their livelihood, but indeed their lives on the line. While I will introduce them appropriately when the panel convenes, just mention their names. They include Marina Namat, a former political prisoner from Iran, Dr. Yang Jianli, a former democracy advocate and political prisoner from China, Dr. Fuzia Said, a person who's singly responsible for the struggle for the adoption of legislation criminalizing sexual harassment in Pakistan after a 10-year struggle. And Flora Terra, who's been the founder of an executive director of Terror Against Terror, engaged in the whole question of combating gender violence and working for democracy in Kenya. These four individuals are really expressive and reflective of a coterie of human rights heroes who are not with us here this evening, many of whom are imprisoned, but people who have shown that with the compassion to care and the courage to act, to put yourself on the line for freedom, you can transform history. And they include Malala Yousafzai, whose advocacy, the 16-year-old who's Pakistani youth, whose advocacy for equal rights has inspired the world over. Maria Lourdes Afluni, a Venezuelan judge detained for nothing other than simply exercising her judicial independence and integrity. Eskender Nega, an Ethiopian journalist imprisoned for doing nothing other than critiquing the Ethiopian government. Nasreen Sotoudeh, an imprisoned Iranian lawyer who, together with the imprisoned Baha'i of Iran, symbolized the struggle for human rights and human dignity in Iran today. Liu Xiaobo, the Chinese Nobel Peace Laureate, imprisoned for exercising his free speech. And Sergei Magnitsky, the Russian lawyer tortured and murdered in detention for exposing the largest corporate tax fraud in Russian history and then paid for it with his life. These heroes and others too numerous to mention, who as we meet, let us not remember, you can find them in the streets of Damascus, in the streets of Cairo, in Belarus, and so on, from Central Asia to Central America. This evening, we should stand in solidarity, remember to stand in solidarity with them, not only to pay tribute to their heroism, but act together with them and join with them in our common cause. And may I close by with the hope and belief that this third global Eckenberg Global Conference on Human Rights, whose founding conference on the prevention of genocide in 2007, still serves as an authoritative template for scholarship and advocacy in the prevention and punishment of mass atrocity. That this conference will yet again, and perhaps even more so, provide a valuable opportunity for jurists, scholars, students, decision makers, human rights defenders, and as Gordon mentioned and others, and young leaders who have come together from all across the globe to share yours and our diverse experiences and expertise in an engaged forum, because this is what it's all about, in an engaged forum for both learning and action, the whole essential to the promotion and protection of democracy, human rights, and freedom, and that, in fact, is what this conference is all about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Merci beaucoup, Erwin. So it's always... Now I'd like to introduce our two musicians. We're going to have a short musical interlude before we invite our featured panelists to come up to the stage. And I'm very, very happy to welcome Charlotte Ann Malachewski, who is a law student at the faculty, and she'll also be a human rights intern in our human rights internship program next summer. And her colleague, Duncan Cameron, who is a Juno Award-winning guitar player. And they are going to play some traditional music from Newfoundland, Ireland, and Quebec. And please join me in welcoming them to the event. you very much. And they'll be playing another number for us at the, after the final video presentation at the end of tonight's program. That's a true inspiration and reminds us as well the importance of music to social transformation. And so with that, I'd like to now invite our featured panelists to come up onto the stage, as well as the moderator, the Honorable Erwin Kotler. And for and as I say, there was a slight change in the program. We'll be having the Young Leaders video shown after the panel event. So please make your way to the stage. I think you're in the front row there. So.
Well, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, we meet on the occasion of the emergence of courageous voices in the struggle for freedom, democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. And it could not happen at a more opportune time because we are at this transformative, indeed revolutionary, moment in human history. In fact, and Colleen mentioned, there are a coterie of almost world historical events that are taking place at the same time, some converging one with the other, and frame the narratives of the revolutionary moment, this transformative moment in our history. They include meeting on the occasion of the, as Colleen mentioned, the second anniversary of the Arab Awakening, which helped inspire this conference to begin with. An Arab Awakening with its competing hopes for, yet threats to, democracy and dignity. As the unrelenting horror in Syria continues unabated, and is even intensifying. And I would be remiss if I passed over what is now happening, where we are reaching such tragic milestones. And let us not forget that it was 2 years ago that the democracy and dignity protests began in Dara in southern Syria with a group of young people scrawling some graffiti on a wall, pursuant to which they were then all arrested and tortured. And when civilians came out in Syria and Dara and Damascus to protest, they were fired upon by Syrian forces. And then the Syrian dignity and democracy revolution began. But 2 years later, 2 years later, we have some 80,000 dead, thousands detained and disappeared, 1 million refugees increasing at 7,000 a day, two-thirds of whom are women and children, 3 million internally displaced. I can go on, but behind every number, behind every statistic, are human beings, most of whom, innocent women and children in this slaughter of innocents. In fact, recently, UNICEF and Save the Children both reported that there are some 2 million children in Syria that have been either killed or tortured or raped or abducted or disappeared. And I mention Syria because I think this makes a mockery, almost, of the international doctrine of the responsibility to protect. And we see once again, the international community as bystander, which took us down the road to the genocides in former Yugoslavia, Rwanda, and Darfur as it did with the Holocaust. And that is why it is so important, I think, and compelling that we have such a courageous panel here this evening. People whose individual stories, whose individual engagement are really, to use that sometimes abused cliche, but which holds true in the case of each of our four panelists this evening, profiles in courage. I'm going to introduce them all at the same time, so you can get a sense of this critical mass of courage represented here. And then I'll call on each of them in order to, in which I'm introducing them, to then speak. First is Marina Namat, the award-winning Iranian-Canadian, who was the recipient of the inaugural, among other prizes, but the inaugural Human Dignity Award from the European Parliament, whose memoir, Prisoner of Tehran, has been published in 28 countries, and who will be speaking appropriately enough on Nowruz, the start of the Persian New Year, and at a time when Iran has itself emerged as a threat to international peace and security, to regional and Middle East stability, and increasingly, and alarmingly so, to its own citizens. And where, therefore, Senator Mark Kirk of the United States and I, as co-chairs of the Iranian Parliamentary Group, or the Global Parliamentary Group for Human Rights in Iran, have today called on Iran, Senator Kirk in the States, myself here in Canada, along with other parliamentarians throughout the world, have called on Iran to uphold its international obligations, to cease and desist from its massive domestic repression, and to release its political prisoners. Our second speaker will be Dr. Yang Jianli, an internationally recognized Chinese human rights scholar. I was amazed to learn, I thought I knew Yang well, but his modesty prevented me from appreciating he's actually the holder of two doctorates, one in mathematics, another in government, from both Berkeley and Harvard, respectively, and is himself a former political prisoner active in the Chinese democracy movement for over three decades. His talk, just as Marina's talk, takes place at a historical moment in Iran history. His will take place as a new political leadership emerges in China amidst its massive domestic repression, symbolized by the imprisonment of Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo, on whose international legal team I had the privilege to be part of it, along with Jared Genzer, who I don't know if he's yet arrived, who's singularly responsible for the release of Dr. Yang Jianli, and who'll be joining our conference, yet another human rights hero. Doctor, I want the floor to her. Did you want to go last or third? Or you're last. Okay, so I was right. The third panelist will be Flora Terra, the founder and executive director of Terra Against Terror, a Kenyan group that advocates on behalf of victims of gendered violence and works to strengthen the democratic process in Kenya. Ms. Terra was herself a parliamentary candidate in the elections in Kenya in 2007, during which time she was abducted, beaten, and tortured, and her only son was murdered. Again, her talk takes place in the immediate aftermath of the Kenyan elections, which saw Uhuru Kenyatta elected president, though Mr. Kenyatta has been charged by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, for organizing criminal gangs in the very parliamentary elections in which Flora was the object of that violence. And our final panelist will be Dr. Fuzia Saeed, a distinguished Pakistani social activist and community leader, recognized as she has been for her, and I quote, courageous action for freedom and democracy. For among other things, he secured landmark legislation after a 10-year struggle criminalizing sexual harassment in Pakistan. And here, too, Dr. Saeed's talk takes place in the immediate aftermath of assaults on religious minorities in Pakistan, assaults on women in Pakistan, and on the eve of elections in that country's transition to democracy. So you see why I say this is a rare coming together, not only of a network of talents, but of a critical mass of engagement and courage. And so it's my pleasure now to invite Marina Namat to open up the panel.
Hello, good evening. First of all, please allow me to thank all of you who have come out, and especially thanking all the organizers of this conference. You have been just wonderful. You have been kind. You have been generous, and I'm grateful to you. And as also, my gratitude goes to the other panelists. You are really, you know, this is an honor, basically, to know you, to share the same stage with you, and you know, I wish there were the proper words to carry my gratitude, but it is an honor. I think that would have to suffice, because there's really nothing more to say. Thank you. I was born in 1965 in Tehran, Iran, and back then Iran was not an Islamic republic. We had a king, we called him the Shah. When I was growing up in Iran, I was just a kid, a normal kid, living under secular laws that allowed us to have some personal liberties, of course, no political liberties, but personal liberties were there. My father was a ballroom dancing instructor. My mother was a hairdresser. I grew up between the sounds of the cha-cha and the tango and women with really big poofy hair. And every Thursday night, I watched the Donny and Marie Osmond show. Every Friday night, I watched The Little House on the Prairie, dubbed into Farsi. And we owned a cottage by the Caspian Sea. Very warm, nothing like the lakes in Canada. And miles of sandy beaches far as the eye can see. I had a green bikini with white polka dots when I turned 13, which was my most valued possession. And all I cared about, when I turned 13, the summer before the revolution, was boys. That was it. And I wanted to become a medical doctor. Women could become whatever they wanted. A woman could become a judge. A woman could become the prime minister. We had secular laws. And I was going to become a medical doctor, and I was going to marry Donny Osmond and live happily ever after. And that was a really good plan, but it didn't work out, very unfortunately. So the revolution happened. We don't have much time. I'm not going to get in a lot of detail, but as you might know, the revolution, just like every other revolution that has ever happened in the history of mankind, promised the people of Iran freedom and democracy. That is what Ayatollah Khomeini, a religious leader, turned very political, promised the people. He promised to step down from power as soon as the revolution succeeded, as soon as the Shah left. Well, the Shah left. Khomeini returned to Iran from exile, and guess what? He took all the power in his own hands. He became the supreme leader of Iran, and he had the final say in everything. Khomeini, and right now, the supreme leader, Khomeini, they can veto the decisions of the parliament, the decisions of everybody. Basically, they get the last word. Anyhow, the schools had been shut down. They reopened again. I was 13 years old, went back to school. At the beginning, it was fabulous, because all of the old laws were out the window and the new laws were being written. So we had a period when, just a few months, when anything went. You could say anything, you could do anything. And trust me, if you're 13 years old and that happens to you, that's the best thing that can ever happen. I had never heard the words Marx and Lenin, and this was in the 70s, and actually in Asia, in many parts of Asia, in South America, being Marxist was cool. So all of the older kids, they were Marxists, and I was devout Catholic going, well, I wasn't really a devout Catholic. I really went to church every day because I was looking for a boyfriend. But in reality, you know, that's the truth of it. But at the same time, during the day, I was taking part in reading sessions and finding out about social justice and democracy and freedom and all of these amazing big words. And then things began to change. Well, horror in history doesn't happen overnight. It is not that you go to bed tonight and tomorrow you have Stalin, Mao, or Khomeini for that matter on your hands. It happens little by little. Our freedoms that we take for granted, the average citizen takes them for granted, are taken away. But who are the people who first notice this missing of personal liberties or political liberties or everything? They are the writers, they are the professors, they are the thinkers, they are the journalists. And as the average person is going about doing their business, paying their mortgage and making their car payments and arguing with their teenagers, these people are losing their jobs, they're being forced into retirement, sometimes they are being put in prison. And these are the first warning signs. Then gradually certain things become illegal. You know, reading certain things, publishing certain things, having a certain religion, being of a certain ethnicity. And this is when horror is unfolding, and this is the time to actually speak out and do something about it. In Iran, the same thing happened. Actually, not only didn't the revolution deliver the freedoms it had promised, it took away our personal freedoms. Having fun became illegal. Imagine you're 14 years old, you have grown up dancing to the Bee Gees on the beach and wearing bikinis, and now they're telling you that you have to cover up, you're not allowed to dance, you're not allowed to sing, you're not allowed to hold your boyfriend's hand in public. Fun has become illegal. What are you going to do? You are going to stand up and you are going to protest because you are the generation of the revolution, and that's exactly what we did. The movie Argo recently came out about the American hostages in Iran, terrible thing that happened shortly after the success of the revolution. But did you know, many of you probably don't, that at the same time that those Americans were taken hostage, they were freed eventually. But thousands of young Iranians, my generation, my friends and I, at the same time, we were on the streets of Tehran yelling and protesting the new policies of the Islamic Republic. And the world didn't hear about it because all foreign journalists had been expelled, because an iron wall had gone up around Iran. There was no Facebook, there was no internet, nobody heard about it. And we were being shot at as early as 1980. People were dying on the streets of Tehran, teenagers. And then the wave of mass arrests of young people began in 1981, in spring. I was arrested in January 1982 at home. I was about to take a bath. I was 16. The door rang 10 o'clock at night. My mom calls my name. I opened the bathroom door. There are two guns pointed in my face. People have asked me, were you scared? No, I was not. Do you know why? Because fear is a luxury. At that moment, I entered a state of shock. That for 30 years after that, I have struggled to get out of, and I haven't exactly managed to do it. A state of shock is a gift from God. It's like body armor. But it doesn't protect you against bullets. It protects you against emotion. My mom and dad were crying. I was looking at them. I couldn't understand why they were crying. No big deal. I'm getting arrested. And the guards put me in a car and took me north to Evin prison, which is 100% operational right now and has about 7,000 prisoners. Nothing has changed. This is not past tense. This is present tense. This is as we speak, and it's becoming more brutal by the day. So I was taken into prison and blindfolded upon arrival, another intimidation technique, taken for interrogation. They questioned me, you know, have you attended protest rallies? Well, yeah, I have attended protest rallies. Have you written articles against the government? Well, yeah, that's no state secret. Yeah, I wrote articles in my school newspaper. I was 16 years old and 90 pounds. Yes. They took me to another room, and there they took off my blindfold. I was in a small room with two men, Ali and Hamid. There was a desk, two chairs, and a bare wooden bed. They asked me questions again, including the whereabouts of this girl. I didn't even know her last name. I didn't know where she lived. Yeah, I had met her once, but I didn't really know her. If I knew, I would have told. I had no reason not to. I wasn't a member of any political organization. I just wanted to have fun. And that was why I ended up in Evin prison. I just wanted to get an education. I just wanted to be able to go out with boys. And that was the reason. I had no reason to lie. So they tied me to the bear with it. First, they handcuffed me. And when they handcuffed me, I was 90 pounds. They saw that my hands are just going to slide out of the cuff. So they put both of my wrists together, and they put the two wrists in one cuff. And as it clicked, my right wrist cracked. I screamed my head off. If the devil, now I'm a Catholic. If the devil had appeared and had told me, Marina, sell me your soul, I'm going to get you back home to your mommy, I would have sold my soul with whipped cream on top. I would have done anything to get out of that room and go home. But that was not an option. They tied me to the bear with umbrella. I was lying down on my stomach. They took off my socks and my shoes. And one of the men, Hamid, he lashed the soles of my feet full force with all of the hatred he could muster with a length of cable. With every strike, your whole nervous system explodes and then it's magically put back together and you're wide awake for the next. I call that space distilled pain. That is the living hell. You lose your identity. You forget who you are. You forget where you come from. You forget where you're going. You don't even know how to count. You want to count those strikes. You want to know how many times are they going to be able to do this to your body, and you can't. You don't know what is after five. Torture is not designed to get information. Torture is designed to break the human soul. That is what they're trying to do to you. I don't know what I said under torture. They gave me papers to sign. I signed everything. Do you think you're going to read that stuff? No, put your name here. You put your name here, period. What they're trying to do, they are not trying to kill you. They are trying to kill your soul. If they want to kill you, they will put you in front of a firing squad. It's much easier and much more economical. When they were done with me, I sat up. I looked at my feet and I laughed out loud. They looked like birthday balloons with toes on them. Then they made me walk. Then they start all over. They make you walk. They start all over. Why stagger? Because if they continue beating, your skin would break and you would die from bleeding and infection. Remember, they are not trying to kill you. They want to kill you. They'll put you in front of a firing squad. Then I was sent, I was given a death sentence. A courtroom in Evin is a Sharia judge sitting behind a desk passing verdicts every 3 minutes. Right now it's the same. There's no lawyer, there's no jury, there's nothing. And they give death sentences like candy. So I was given a death sentence, reduced to life in prison. I was sent to the cell block with thousands of other girls, 90% of us under the age of 20. High school in hell. The first night I wake up in the middle of the night, and I want to go to the bathroom. I can't because there are so many people sleeping next to each other on the floor that it's impossible to make it to the bathroom, which is down the hallway, because there is no space between the people to put your foot down. During the day, we stand in the bathroom line all day. And as we are signing, names are being announced over the loudspeaker, so and so and so and so, come to the bathroom, come to the office. So the people who are called, you're being taken for torture and maybe even execution. If your name is called, go and go quickly, because if you don't and you fuss, they will come and shoot you right here. You have a better chance if you go nicely. So those go. The rest of us, we are standing in line. We are teenagers. What are we doing? We are talking. What are we talking about? About everything that makes you human. I had never thought about what made me human until I stood in bathroom line in Evin prison. It is the memory of the people who care about you and the people you care about. In a place of darkness, you have to create hope, even if it's vague. So we talked about birthday parties, family reunions, family get-togethers, Donya and Marie Osmond, the Caspian Sea bikinis. And by doing this, we created the hope that we needed. Many of the girls who stood in bathroom line with me in Evin are buried in mass graves. And I'm standing. Why? I have no idea. I have asked that question for myself a million times. Why me? but I'm here and there's not much I can do about it. You know why? I'd rather go jump off a really tall building. I'm really tempted to do that every once in a while. But my friends who died in Evin prison, they didn't choose to die a horrible death at the age of 15. They didn't make that choice. My life is theirs more than it is mine. I cannot waste my life because it belongs to those 15-year-olds buried in mass graves in Iran. I wish it wasn't this way, but it is. In Evin prison, girls were raped repeatedly under the name of marriage. There's something called temporary marriage under Iranian law. So a prisoner girl who's less than a slave would be married off to an interrogator, a guard, being raped over and over again. I was one of those girls. Being raped over and over again in solitary confinement in Evin prison. And the man that I was forced to marry, he took me on short leaves of absence to visit his family. And I expected his mother to be the evil stepmother from Cinderella and torment me more. But this little normal woman came, opened the door, and took me in her kitchen. All the food in the fridge landed on the table in front of me. And she talked to me. She was normal. And I looked at her and I thought, how did this happen? How did this good woman produce a son who was a torturer? And I realized, oh, the tables turn. One day, and this man had been a political prisoner in Evin prison during the time of the Shah, had been tortured terribly for 3 years. And then the tables turned and the tortured became the torturer. And I realized the same thing will happen to me. One day, somebody will put a length of cable in my hand and say, go for it. Go get your justice, revenge, you know, whatever. One day, somebody will make me the minister of justice. No, actually, it's minister of revenge, but that's okay. They made me convert to Islam in Evin prison. They changed my name. And when I thought about it, I realized they can take away your freedom, your family, your dignity, your religion, your name, but there's one thing they cannot take away from you, and that is who you really are, which has nothing to do with the above. It is the answer that you give to that length of cable. The tortured has become the torturer since the dawn of time. It's just a cycle. It keeps on repeating. The chicken or the egg. I don't know. But I am going to break it. And actually, when I think about breaking the cycle of torture, I think of that young man in Tiananmen Square. One young man is standing in front of the tank with nothing in his hands. This dragon of violence cannot be killed with a silver sword. This is the dragon that you have to look at straight in the eye and say, I know you, I recognize you, and I don't like you. And I'm going to stand here and I'm going to expose you and I'm going to fight you with every breath that God has given me. And that is the way to fight it. Because if you give it violence, you're going to become one of his heads. And that's not going to work. Now I'm going to end with one request. One simple request. I'm not trying to achieve world peace. In Iran, thousands, since 33 years ago, the success of the revolution, some estimates tell us that 50, 60, 70,000 political prisoners have just been executed, let alone the lives devastated. I don't know one family in Iran that hasn't been touched by this situation. What is the issue with Iran? Is it really the nuclear situation that is threatening the world? No. How many people have died because of the nuclear program? Nobody so far. But I can tell you that tens of thousands of people have died because of the terrible disregard for human rights in that country. And I have thought about how do we fight this without bombing anybody and costing more innocent lives, that is. And I have come with one simple solution, and I'm going to ask you to support me. I'm going to start a petition and to ask the UN and all free countries in the world to support this cause. It's very simple. Every time a government official, anybody on the higher level, doesn't matter who it is given the microphone on a world stage, whether it is CNN, it's the UN, it's the European Union, it's a conference, whatever, every single time that an Iranian official is given the mic, I believe my enemies, they have the right to speak the same way that I do. That's fine. Don't stop them. Let them come, let them speak. But on the same stage, I ask, that every time these people speak, an ex-political prisoner from Iran, a victim of torture, be given the same microphone and be given the same amount of time. Please, I beg you, give us the opportunity to look at our torturers straight in the eye and say, you did this to me. Please tell me why. Thank you so, so much for your time.
Thank you, Marina, for that eloquent and compelling, you know, personal testimony and even call to action in that regard. And I have Dr. Yang Jianli and hear his testimony, in effect.
Thank you, Irvin. Bonsoir. Good evening, dear friends. It is sad to say today, we live in a land of shadows, stark shadows cast by worst in us on what is best. We recall in 1948, shortly after one of the worst convulsions of violence in the history of mankind drew close, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the newly formed United Nations. This was a ray of light in the world still shrouded in darkness. This light of hope was emitted from the best human hearts and minds, including that of John Humphrey, one of the greatest scientists of McGill University. So I feel honored and humbled to stand here tonight. Dear friends, what is best in us and what is most hopeful about us is beautifully articulated in the Declaration. These are the principles by which we should organize ourselves as a human family. These are the principles at the core of any meaningful democracy. And yet, too many of our eyes have adjusted to the shadows that the power and the greed cast on the existence of our brothers and sisters around the world. Whereas the brave and visionary people like John Humphrey could see a world beyond catastrophe they had just endured, we live in an age where what has been gained in principle, what has been recognized in fact, has been eroded by an acceptance that it is better to accommodate the evil and hope it changes on its own than to seek to change it through pressure, denouncement, and a direct confrontation. We must ask today, how is it that this Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which affirms the faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, and in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations, large and small, is so casually traduced by many of its signatory states, including China? We have gathered here in the shadowy valley of our times to summon the wisdom and the best heritage of mankind and to remind the entire world once again that each one of us has an opportunity to act in a way worthy of the best of our humanity. The other option is to adjust our eyes to the shadows. But my friends, I have seen firsthand what takes place in these shadows. I was born 3 years before the Cultural Revolution. At an early age, the unspeakable sufferings that most family had at the hands of the communist dictatorship, including mine, made me disenchanted with the Communist Party. However, I was enticed into joining the party with the idea of reforming it from within. This all changed when I returned from my PhD studies in US to join thousands of my fellow students in Beijing as Chinese army tanks rode across Tiananmen Square on the morning of June 4th, 1989. Luckier than most of my fellow students, I narrowly escaped the massacre and the ensuing arrests and returned to the United States. While I continued my studies, I immersed myself in the work advancing human rights and democracy in China. In the party's eyes, the former young communist star had become a public enemy. I became persona non grata, a traitor prohibited from entering China. But in the spring of 2002, I decided to defy the ban. In China industrial northeast, thousands of workers were taken to the street, protesting the destitution brought on by the government exploiting policies. Seizing an opportunity to forge bonds between democracy leaders and the grassroots activists, I entered China using a borrowed passport and a forged ID card. For 2 weeks, I met with exploited construction laborers, expropriated farmers, and striking workers, documenting their grievances and the condition of their lives, and helping them with nonviolent struggle strategies. But as I attempted to slip out of China across the Burmese border, my fake ID was spotted, and I found myself in the hands of the security police. I was detained for 5 years. Much of those years I spent in solitary confinement. My mental condition deteriorated beneath endless isolation, repeated interrogations, and ongoing psychological and physical tortures. I resorted to composing poems in my head and committing them to memory as means of maintaining my sanity. Nearing a breakdown, I grasped onto my innermost resources of imagination, belief, and will to fend off insanity and find a reason to live. Am I wrong? I asked myself with a tinge of regret, but I repeated a thought experiment, imagining of myself taking a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, arbitrarily choosing anyone on the Chinese street, showing the document, asking them with the language they can understand whether they want the rights listed there. Would anybody say no? Of course not. Nobody wants to be slave. In this regard, the Chinese people are no different than any people in the world. The thirst for freedom and dignity is indeed universal. I drew strength and inspiration from this first order of fact. I also thought of my fallen brothers and sisters in Tiananmen Square. I reassured myself that freedom is not free. Freedom must be earned. It was not free for those who paid with their lives. It is certainly not free for those of us who, while still blessed with our lives, have yet to complete the mission for which these brave students gave their lives and their freedom. I must not give up. Long story short, in 2007, thanks to the overwhelming international support, I was freed, returned to the U.S., and recommitted myself to the hard work to advance human rights and democracy in China. Today, we are in the situation that is both more dire and more hopeful than that faced by the demonstrators of 1989. On the one hand, the Chinese government has adjusted to new realities in order to maintain hold on power. They have willingly jettisoned their ideology and allowed a distinctly undemocratic capitalism to supplant undemocratic communism in hopes that individual wealth will end demands for individual freedoms. But it will not. It cannot, because the desire for freedom is too great. It is too deeply rooted in all of the peoples who make up our common humanity. Consider the numbers of people who engage in activities the Chinese government, with all of the resources at its disposal, aims to prevent or actually crack down on once they have begun. Mass incidents is the term the Chinese government uses to describe a protest in which 100 or more people participate. Even underneath the ever-ready tyrant's baton, the number of these incidents has risen to 180,000 per year, which means that on average, a new large protest against the government policies takes place every 3 minutes. Is it not logical to infer from this fact that no amount of violence or propaganda can ever suppress the desire for freedom? But this does not mean that we in the West can sit back and wait for democracy to bloom. China is a dangerous and a pernicious power, growing more so every day. And quietism or passive engagement are not an answer or an option. Before this regime is done, and one day it will be done, it has the capacity of inflicting enormous damage on its own people and the people of the world. It is our responsibility to ensure that this does not happen. Those people, like John Humphrey in the middle of last century, rose to the challenge of their times in the midst of the worst the world had ever seen. Surely we, with their work as our foundation, can rise to the challenge of our own times. Surely we can all see the shadows for what they are and say, it is time to begin living in the light. Thank you. Merci. Thank you.
Thank you as well for your own compelling testimony and equally riveting call to action and to lead in the light. I'll now call upon Flora, who will provide her experience and testimony.
Good evening. My name is Flora. I was born and brought up at the slopes of Mount Kenya. It's a little bit cold, but not colder than Montreal. We've never had minus 40, but I experienced minus 40 a few weeks ago. Unlike Mariana, when I was growing up, I wanted to be a woman. Why am I saying this? I wanted to be like the girls I went to school with, who had gone through female genital cutting. Then when I was growing up, my family the family around my community was preparing girls for marriage. We were not told so much, we were not given any importance of education. I thank God I know that at this age, and I'm still learning. I managed to finish my primary school and my high school, where I learned English, And still today, I'm learning English, so that's the first time I differentiated between fingers and toes. I would call toes fingers and fingers toes. But right now, if you hear me saying toes, I mean this. So I managed to finish high school, but I got pregnant out of wedlock. And that's when my life changed. I gave birth to a beautiful, bouncing baby boy. And when I was giving birth, we shared a very single bed for people. Whether you had gone through cesarean or not, we shared that bed. And I asked women who were older than me then how they managed to get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 12 kids. And they told me, we know no other way, child. I promised myself when I looked at my boy that I will do something to change my community, not my country, my community, because I'd not gone out of the little village. My dad took me back to college, and I did community development. And I was engaged as an HIV counselor, and it was the most difficult work I ever did. One, because in Kenya or in the African society, we don't talk about death, and we don't talk about sex. So if you have to train on HIV, you have to talk on both. It was a challenge for me, but I didn't manage to train a couple of people, a couple of groups within the country. I traveled about 3 provinces. And in each of these provinces, there are very harmful cultural practices, starting with female genital cutting, which I really wanted when I was in primary school, because other girls had segregated us who had not gone through female genital cutting. There was also child marriage, and there was also widow classing, where if your spouse dies, you have to sleep with his brother or his cousin before the final day. And all these were contributors to HIV and AIDS. To me, yes, I was doing lots of work on it, creating awareness, but isn't that sweeping the floor when the taps are still running? Isn't that dressing a wound without treating it? I thought of so many things that I was doing that was not right. You're telling girls about HIV and AIDS, you're telling women the same, yet the same, probably 16 girls are being taken to the river for the cutting, and they are using one weapon. So if one child is HIV positive, then the rest of the 15 girls get it. If this woman you're telling about HIV positive, the husband has died of AIDS, and she has to be cleansed, then what are you doing? It's a vicious circle. I later joined the women movement to address this, and we thought the only way to do it was to engage the political actors, because that's where the laws are changed. We were then trying to change our constitution, because all these things I'm talking about were in our constitution, not as FGM, but as cultural laws. And you cannot engage them if you don't have numbers in parliament. So what we did was, as women movement, we started engendering the political process by telling women to join in leadership. And as I trained on gender and governance, the women, the same women I was training within my community, told me, lead by example. I couldn't sit at the periphery. I wanted to change my country. I wanted to change the way things were in my country. But that was challenging the status quo. Politics in my country is it's a big boys' club. So getting there, it's very hard. But since I had support, I decided, why not? In 2006, I campaigned so much, and there's no place I did not go in my constituency. There's no madman I didn't know in the village by name. I was told to step down for many people that were running, and that it's the big boys club, and they said, you're still too young. We can support you after 5 years. That's 2012. And I told them, let's go back to the community and let's address the same issue. If the community that have nominated me to run says yes, surely I will support you people. When I didn't let it go, I was threatened. Text messages, which I thought was funny, but through mentorship by other women who had been in the political process, I thought really they didn't mean what they said. But finally it happened. I was tortured, fed with feces. All my hair was ripped off, mixed with the same feces, human waste, and forced down my throat. At this time, I was thinking so many things. What was going through my mind was the commitment I had in me to change my country. What was going in my mind that day, I was lying in the hospital bed, almost half dead. I couldn't talk because my neck disc was dislodged and my left leg was broken. I thought about my son, that boy I held, and said, I'm going to change my country. I thought about him. He wanted to be a football coach. What is he going to say if mama gives up? The only words that came from my mouth was no retreat, no surrender. I wanted other women to learn that they can hurt you physically, but they cannot kill your spirit. Yes, I did vote, and after voting, 3 days later, there was post-election violence. That was in 2008. I'll say the losers were the winners, and the winners were the losers, because really, no one knows, even the commissions that were set, no one knows in Kenya who won the elections in 2008. My country was burning. I was in clashes. I still had my neck brace. My body was paining. But I could not sit or sleep in bed and watch women being raped and children being raped. The youngest child that was raped was 2 months. That kid didn't have a voter's card. Why did we turn disputed elections to be a battle of women's body? I was so annoyed. I was so annoyed that time with my country. I called the women leaders and I told them, we can no longer be in the boardrooms. We have to go and address the real issue. Let's go and face the boys that are doing this. I started a campaign called Terror Against Terror. Terror is my name, against the terror that was happening to women then. We went around the mortuaries counting dead bodies of women and children. It was a very sad day. Well, international community intervened and eminent persons were sent to my country, and the whirling functions decided to share power. And that's the worst thing that can happen into a country, coalition governments, because you have two centers of power. When one says this, the other one says that. When one gets into corruption, the other one perfects corruption. So when that was decided, as women again, we said we need more women to be given positions. And it's at this time when we were lobbying and advocating for women to be given positions within the government. In a boardroom, I received a call. That one boy I've just spoken about, the boy who made me who I am, the anchor of my life, was murdered. With all the tribulations, I put my pen in a piece of paper, and it's a book called They Never Killed My Spirit, But They Murdered My Only Child. What am I doing to redeem my son's spirit? I am a public speaker. I came to a country of hope, a land of hope called Canada. I'm slowly getting my life back, and I'm working with lots of organizations in Canada, Equitas, Jean Savet Foundation, Brian Brofman Foundation, and all these foundations that are dealing with human dignity. I'll speak around the world telling my story. And to you Canadians, what I can tell you is, do not take your privileges for granted. When I speak in schools, that's exactly what I tell the kids. It's the same way I feel those kids are the same children I would have had. So I'll do all I can as Flora to see that I redeem my baby's spirit. And I thank the organizers for giving us such a time to speak to you Canadians and to speak to the people from around the world, to tell them what it is to live in a country where democracy is little known. As I speak today, I came from Kenya 2 days ago. It's very sad that nothing really has changed. The game is the same. All they've done, it's a club where they've changed their dressing. Last year they were wearing red, today they're wearing white. But my question is, when will we ever get our lives back? I won't get my life back until I see the violators, those people that murdered 1,200 people. Tell us why. You leave a woman like me without a grandchild. I stand here because I've been given a platform. There are many other women that are going through the same violations. And I publicly speak that human rights is not a gift from any government. It's a fundamental right. And we all have to wake up and say, enough is enough. Thank you so much. Merci beaucoup. Bonne soirée.
Flora, I think you've demonstrated that the title of this panel, Stories of Engagement and Resilience, was actually an understatement. As I said in my opening remarks, what we have here are real profiles in courage. And as you put it, they killed your only son, but they did not kill your spirit. Our last panelist will be Asia Saeed, and she will share her experience and testimony with us as well.
Hello, everybody. Glad to be here. Very honored to be sitting with very brave people in the audience on the stage. I'm going to talk about my struggles in Pakistan, and I'll see how I can place this. Can I put it on top? Yeah? No, it's okay. I suppose I can use this. I will talk about my activism, my work in Pakistan. And many people have asked me what made me decide to become an activist, and I always say that that is never a decision that you actually consciously take. Because living one's life, especially the childhood, I think women can relate to it a bit more, because as you're growing up, what makes us a woman, and the socialization process is usually don't do this, don't do that, and that is how you shape up to be a woman. So it's don't go out alone, don't go out in the dark, don't go here or there. And that is how we become women. And if people like me who say why and start questioning it and start countering it, that is what makes us an activist. I think I basically have just lived my life, even though that is called activism, but basically lived my life, and whatever roadblocks I experienced personally, I realized those were the roadblocks for other people also, and when I tried to resolve my own issues, I think those kind of blended in with the voices of others. So that is all what my life has been. I have seen domestic violence very closely with people who are very dear to me, and I think that is what really got me into understanding what violence against women means and how we need to restore our own dignity. And that is why in Pakistan I started the very first crisis center. This was in 1990. It was called Bedari, which is awakening, and we started helping out women who were going through violence. And soon I realized, it was after seeing thousands of cases, I realized that we need to change how we view these kinds of violations. And my mind always worked towards, rather than kind of dwelling on what bad is happening, figuring out a way of how we can turn it around. So we tried to work through issues, and we brought in the community to own those issues. And that is how we made violence against women a community issue, not just a woman's issue. And I must say that we are very fortunate to have a very organized women's movement in Pakistan, which over the years, especially fighting several dictators, has evolved. And we do make a lot of fuss, and every time there is a human rights violation, we take to the streets, and we try and follow the case until a time the government takes notice of it. But after years of doing that, I personally felt like we are not going to get anywhere following cases, because we have done thousands, and while we pursue one case, there are thousands others that come up. So we need to come up with a more intelligent strategy. I should also say that this was the time when I thought there were several other important avenues for this kind of work on democracy and human rights, because if women focus on women's rights or minority rights, any one strand of human rights, unless you have a very firm democratic context and a democratic backdrop, you can't really begin to find solutions. And therefore, my work kind of pronged off into different directions, and one was strengthening of democracy, where there are several other activists in Pakistan who worked through different movements. One aspect went into minority rights. One very strong movement that I initiated early on was against militancy, where through media and through community work, we tried to work. But here, because the time was very limited, I'm only going to focus on women's rights. I want to share one experience that turned my approach around in terms of women's rights, and that was when I was working for United Nations. I had gotten my higher education from USA, and I was working with the UN at a very senior, not very senior, but I was the manager of my own unit. And that is when I realized that, ironically, I was heading the gender unit and developing projects of women's empowerment in Pakistan. I experienced very severe sexual harassment through a senior manager within the United Nations. And even though I had been out on the streets and dealing with this crisis center and many other avenues, but it was a different story. I mean, we Pakistani women, 100%, I think like many other women in the world, experience sexual harassment, which is still a very common issue. But going through three years of severe sexual harassment in the Office of United Nations that holds the Charter of Human Human Rights Declaration and everything was quite ironic, and not finding any way to counter that really kind of marked my whole struggle. And that is when I will not go through the details. I've recently finished a book that I wanted to share, and I was happy that finally this is part of my healing too. It has come out a couple of days ago. It's called Working with Sharks, and it deals with that case. But after 2 years of torture, further torture by the management, which included a British resident representative, it included a Japanese deputy, and several other Dutch and many other international people. And among the victims, it was not just me alone. Once I spoke up, there were 10 other women who joined us, and in a staff of 100, there were only 16 women. And we 11 women complained against the same guy. Eight of us were Pakistani, one was Japanese, one was British, one was Dutch. 2 years of further torture, because we thought once we gathered our courage and we reported the case, that would be it, because 11 women were saying pretty much the same thing against one guy, but nothing of that sort. It reminded me of the witch hunt in Once Upon a Time in Europe. You all are familiar with that. And we were almost like witches of the UN, and they were hunted down and tortured in many ways. So that when we concluded that case, in Pakistan, the civil society marked that as the day to acknowledge the struggle against sexual harassment. And at that time, I thought that I was educated, and I had a very supportive family, and I had education, and was confident, and the circumstances were kind of international, what people would believe to have good record of human rights. And if I had so much trouble holding somebody accountable, what are my sisters doing in the factories and in the informal sector and other offices? And I did a research, and I found out that other than United Nations, no other organization had any anti-sexual harassment policy. And even I was not aware of United Nations sexual harassment policy, because I was told again and again that there was none. So we started a movement, and my story is more about the movement, how we managed to get turn the table around. So we started, this was a like-minded group of people, and we started a network called ASHA. ASHA means hope, and my organization that I am associated with is called Mehergarh. Mehergarh became sort of the steering of ASHA, the secretariat of ASHA. And we made sure that we included men and women both, because we wanted to get back to the point. We had three-pronged approach. We really got women together from the grassroots and all the sectors that we could get a hold of. Women, in the beginning, it was not difficult to mobilize them, because every woman knows what sexual harassment is. They all told us that they had eyes in the back of their body and eyes in the front of the body. And they know what a touch means, you know, how to distinguish between what is sexual harassment and what is not. So they came along with us. We, like I said, we got men also involved, and we got urban and rural women all together. I'm going to go through my slides fast, because I know I don't have much time. We got the private sector involved, the labor unions involved, many other sectors, and it was not as easy as it sounds. It took us about 10 years. But in the beginning, it was difficult, because sexual harassment was not a term that was established in Pakistan, and we didn't have an Urdu version for it. So we asked our linguist to coin a term for us. And especially at that time, it was a dictator's rule. So the government, we kept the government engaged, but they were not too helpful for us. And they said that we will not sit in any meeting that will use the word sexual harassment, because this is very obscene and you should not be using that word. And we kept telling them it's okay to sexually harass, but it is not okay to talk about, and they said yes. So we got the private sector involved. It was very difficult in the beginning because they were suspicious of us. We were suspicious of them because, you know, we didn't know their language. And gradually we learned, and I think they also learned, and there were breaking of stereotypes, and there was new learning. They acknowledged that, yes, they have the problem. And everybody acknowledged that. And I said, what do you do with it? And they said, we fire them both because we do not know what to do with it. And so we developed a code of conduct. Actually, it was an anti-sexual harassment policy because many sectors said, you are not going to use the word sexual. We coined a new term, and we called an anti-sexual harassment policy the code of conduct for gender justice. And that floated. We got our stars together. We really learned a lot what will make things happen. And we got our television stars and our film stars on board. And I think because we were so passionate about it and the communication really came out of our hearts, that they also came on board with us. We even got the religious sorts on our side, and we really took out evidence from the religious scriptures, even though we didn't trust them fully, but we tried our best. We got the mainstream media on our side. It also took a while. Everything took a while because we had to educate people, sensitize people, and then bring them to our side. We got the mainstream media involved, and believe it or not, we have about 70 private channels now, very conscious about their budgets, but they were willing to do public service messages for free. They were willing to do full programs, etc. We used to do 2 one-month campaign every year, and that went side by side. And let me just back off a bit. What happened in 2008, our democratic rule returned to our country after a very long, about 10 years of dictatorship. And that was the time we felt like we could go and talk to our parliament, because elected representatives have a different kind of a sovereign relationship with your people. And so with high hopes and zero contacts, we contacted our women parliamentarians. And I must say this alone, having women in the parliament has been almost a 30-year battle. And now we have about 200 women in our parliament, and I also want to acknowledge that at least 50% of them are women who are there because of their own capability. There was a time when we fought for reserve seats like anything, and almost 100% of women were those who came from elite classes and because somebody was in power, you know, from that kind of background. But now things have gradually changed. And we do have women that can be like a starting point for us to go in and lobby. We started contacting our parliamentarians. And in the beginning, it was, again, very difficult because women's issues are usually trivialized. It is not a high priority. Pakistan, with a lot of economic, social issues, women's issues was not up there. And before us, before Asha, it was... There was not a single example where the civil society actually crossed over, or women's movement crossed over into the parliament, because we have a tradition of bashing each other. So the civil society bashes the government a lot, and the government mistrusts the civil society a lot. So I think this was our initiative to tell them that we want to play as a team, and we were happy that democracy was back in our country, and we really wanted to get to the essence of it and not just have a token democracy, citizens actually talking to their representatives. So that really grabbed them, and they started helping us out. We talked to several senior. We were very committed to talk to every party so that the whole parliament really feels that they are dealing with citizens. And we wanted it stamped by every party so that we can have an easier round when it comes to implementation. Again, there are loads of stories I can tell you, but I will not because I have little time. But it was quite funny how everybody in the Parliament House kind of became our supporter eventually. It took us about 2.5 years to lobby our way through. The people who run the elevators, the security guards, the assistants, the office assistants, people who give messages inside the house, you know, they all kind of, we talk to them as they were fathers of daughters who are going to experience whatever they will experience in their lives. And we said, this is your opportunity and our opportunity to make the society more safe, more dignified for your daughters and for all of us. And we just had such an emotional experience of lobbying through the parliament, other than the parliamentarians themselves. It was people praying for us so that we could get our bill passed. This is the day when we got the bills through our first house. You see our speaker on the left side, the right side. She's a woman also, was very supportive. And many women parliamentarians and men parliamentarians, they spoke up. Typically what happens in Pakistan in past, I must tell you that this process came about after about a 50 years gap, the last comprehensive progressive legislation that came, that passed, was in 1950s. So this was a very special day. We had invited all kinds of working women to the parliament, sitting in the galleries, in their uniforms, very excited, and we wanted to build a strand of solidarity with the women parliamentarians also, because we said, you are working women also, and you experience harassment, so you have to side with us. This is just all of us standing there. You see Sheri Rahman in the middle, who is now the ambassador to the to United States from Pakistan. Many other politicians. It passed through both the houses, and finally in 2010, March 8th, 9th, which was International Women's Day, we were very happy that two laws passed Pakistan's parliament, signed by the President of Pakistan, and this made sexual harassment for the first time in the history of Pakistan a crime. Two laws, one criminalizing the offense, the other one, a very comprehensive one, giving a whole implementation mechanism of how the formal sector would deal with it. And the president, it was a whole, I must say, like a psychological thing. I think earlier, every time a religious leader would speak up and say something negative, everybody would go and start walking on eggshells. And I think because of these laws, because people were so emotional about it and the politicians really, really came on and supported us, they broke through that also. At the very end, we got a lot of resistance from many guys with big beards. And they said, you immoral women, you know, it is your issue. It is not Pakistani women's issue. Because you are so westernized and immoral, so you get harassed, not everybody else. But I'm very proud of our parliamentarians who stood by us. And those people quickly turned into a very small minority, and we got through the bill. And the president invited 100 women of substance from the whole country. No bill gets signed like this bill got signed. And 100 women that they selected flew from different parts of the country, and we witnessed the signing of the bill. And the parliament was so happy for the first time. It seemed the civil society was not bashing them. And actually, they were distributing sweets and dancing around. It was like a nationwide celebration. And it was a very odd experience, odd in a sense of it was a unique experience, because rural women and urban women and many sectors, we celebrated together. So then the government turned around and they said, okay, what can we do more? So that was very exciting for us, because we had very detailed plans in terms of implementation frameworks and detailed plans, and we quickly shared that with them. And we made, here I would just briefly say that it was a very kind of detailed planning of how it will be implemented step by step in the whole country. And we went through regulatory bodies, and we said it is your responsibility and not just the civil society. So we really got under the skin of the government structure. And also, I would like to share that it was a very difficult process, painful process, especially in the beginning. And then as the things turned around, that is what the beauty of democracy is, that even though it is, it might be on crutches, but the democratic government brings people closer to the ruling class. And no matter how weak it is, it really brings opportunities for you. So it had a domino effect, and parliamentarians also were happy to do something for the citizens. So we, in a row, got 7 laws passed through our parliament in the last 2 years, which was an amazing amazing achievement for all of us. I would quickly like to just mention one was on ACID attacks. Now, anytime there is an ACID attack, it is horrible, and it is a slap in the face of the whole society or humanity. But I must say that it does go around in the international media a lot. But I'm sad to say that the struggles that we go through in order to make these crimes crimes and in order to bring around the elite to see these crimes and the ruling parties to actually legislate against these crimes is not taken up by the media. So this was one criminalization of ACID attacks. We also had another amendment which criminalized four bad practices that still prevailed in our patriarchal system, and that is giving women in exchange for conflict resolution, stopping their inheritance, forced marriage, and there is still a tradition that we have remnants of, which is marrying Holy Quran. Then we had another law that was for women who cannot pay their bail money. Sometimes they just stay in the jails. We had another law which was about strengthening an institution which is a watchdog body for women's issues. So we have had that institution for about 10 years, but it didn't have any teeth. So we revised the whole legislation. Now we can actually do many things with that institution. Now, in terms of my lessons, I think one was that we engaged, and we were only able to engage because it was a democratic system. Engagement is very important. I feel sometimes our movement gets into the groove of complaining and bashing, whereas we need to come around and start working as a team so that whatever level of democratic law we have, we strengthen it together. In terms of international lessons, I just want to say that sharing the struggles, like we all are sharing our struggles with people, is very important. I always find the bashing around the issue only or taking our problems and taking it around the media doesn't help us who are within that country and struggling against that. What helps us is when media says something positive about anything positive that happens in a country. You know, if there is actually a legislation or implementation of legislation or something that happens in a democratic system, and these are, to me, indicators of a maturing democracy, which we need international support on. That is how the indigenous movements will find their strength, when we get international support from anything positive or any sign of a maturing democracy. So at the end, I would just say that I want to share our struggle, and that is why I have written my book. And my fellow sisters here have written their books, because we want to share the struggles. And we need solidarity, not just in the violation part of it, but in the struggles. Thank you.
I thank you for chronicling your struggle and for sharing it with us, as well as the lessons emerging from it. I'd like at this point to maybe ask the panelists if they have anything they might want to ask of each other or comment on any of the fellow panelists' presentation.
Well, I guess I would just like to say that, you know, no matter how many of these conferences I attend, and, you know, we all know we attend many, and, you know, we live out of a suitcase, basically. But it doesn't matter how many of these you attend. Every single time I sit down, I feel humbled and, you know, getting educated on what is going on in the world, and exactly not to just complain, but to actually come up with practical steps. You know, again, world peace, you know, that's a beautiful word, but, you know, just to come up with these small legislations, let's say if we are talking democratic society, but if we are talking, for example, like a dictatorship, like for my country, Iran, what can actually be done short of, you know, killing more innocent people that is not exactly needed. And I mean, the more of these conferences that I attend, the more I learn that, you know, these ideas are really worth sharing and discussing and pondering upon. So, you know, again, I want to thank everybody for their for the education they have given me. It's been just phenomenal. Thank you.
I want to share something. I feel like we have repressive regimes all over the world, and we keep fighting against repressive regimes wherever there are dictatorships or different kinds of dictatorships. But also there is a centuries-old patriarchal system and a power system where there is power hierarchy, very strong power hierarchy and patriarchy, and our fight is against that also because that comes through in different ways. And many a times repressive regimes are also a reflection of that power hierarchy. And those appear in developed countries also from time to time in different ways, and in the third world countries more in our faces, so that is more recognizable. But I think it is the universal thread that we need to look at and not divide up the world into those that have repressive regimes and those who do not, because I think that human rights is something which is very closely attached to an individual. And so the violation can happen from a regime, or violation can happen from your neighbor, you know, or your family member. And so we need to kind of keep a tab and not fall into the trap where we feel like, okay, now we don't have a repressive regime, so everything is okay. That strand is very much around, and human rights remain the rights of an individual.
Well, I'm very much humbled by the three women in front of me, by their struggle, amazing stories. And just my salute to every one of you. And your story is a bit different from others because you have a democratic system to work with.
Recent, yes.
Yeah.
2008.
Yeah, yeah. And you have a success. Your activism has success to a certain degree. So my question to you is how you evaluate the Pakistani democracy system, how well you think it generally functioning based on your personal experience. And to you two sisters, there is a saying that China is behind every dictator on the globe. To what extent you believe so? And do you feel the China's presence in your respective country? And in other words, how do you think the China's democracy affect your situation in your country?
Okay, I can start. I usually do not really evaluate things like that. Just because if somebody says to me this anti-sexual harassment laws were passed 2 years ago, so is the harassment gone? No, it is not. To me, I think because we are very greedy for change and we yearn for change, that any indicator gives us a lot of strength. So that is how I evaluate. I do not evaluate whether we have ultimate democracy or not. But what one sees is one sees clear indicators of maturing democracy. And despite of the economic situation and several other situations with minorities, I think that I can give you 5-6 very solid examples of where things have started changing. The process has started. You know, we have had a constitutional reform after 1973, where every dictator skewed the constitution to the extent that we couldn't even recognize our constitution. And so at least a major portion was returned back to us. And with 100% consensus of 14 different parties ranging from extreme left to extreme right. So I am now in United States doing my fellowship, and whoever I have talked to, they just go, you know, nothing. It doesn't mean anything to them. And I get very surprised because for us, it means a lot. It means, you know, living through several dictatorships where a citizen had absolutely no right to see political parties beginning to get their act together is a very big thing. So that is why I say that internationally also, when you see sparks like that, hopeful sparks, the international community should respond and not continue to bash, you know, for all those years of repression that we have gone through. and certain things that we have recently achieved that came after a struggle of almost 60 years. Small things, but we have our hope tagged to those processes. So that is my evaluation.
Thank you.
Can I add to that?
Yes, please.
What I'm learning from every conference I'm going to is women issues are very all cross-cutting. Like she was talking about the Sexual Offences Act. We also had it in 2005. So I think we need to run more on how to engage because women issues in Pakistan, in Iran, probably in China, are all cross-cutting and... We are different countries with the same story.
The universality of it is very much there.
You know, it strikes me, I'm wondering because I know that I'm soon going to be advised that the time is up, so that there is a question that I'd like to put, almost the same one to all of you in this regard. You all come from different regions, countries, cultures. Marina, you come from Iran in the Middle East. Laura, you come from Kenya and Africa. Fazia, you come from Pakistan.
South Asia.
Yes, and also from China and Asia. And each of you have been the victims of gross human rights violations in three of the cases. In fact, the victim of torture, both psychological and physical. You've all, in effect, experienced affronts, you know, to your own personal dignity. And my question, and all of you, in some form or another, have lived under a dictatorship. Two are still living under dictatorships, and two under, let's say, transitional democracy. My questions are, really, to each of you, what gave you the courage to go on, given the victimization that you were experienced, number one? And two, what gave you the inspiration to struggle for democracy when you were either living and, in some instances, continuing to live in a dictatorship like in Iran or China, or in countries that went through a dictatorship in Kenya? But what gave you the courage, you know, to go on? What is there from these two questions that may have something for us to take away in terms of what we need to do?
Should I start?
Yeah.
Okay. I think one basic thing for me is that there is no option for me to accept a situation which is not dignified for me. So human dignity comes as very basic, and I have learned through my life that it doesn't matter if all of you respect me or not, but I will respect myself. So I think that feeling that there is no way I would let anybody be disrespectful or violate my dignity, I think that feeling is what keeps me going, because I may not be able to get back at that one person, but getting back at the whole system which allows that indignity is where my thing comes from. And then I think the solidarity is just such a beautiful magic. This sense of solidarity may be with a woman who's working in a factory, in a farm, wherever. But that solidarity just is an enormous strength. So that is one. And I think this democracy thing is also a learning, because we realize that no matter how much we work for and we inch our way forward, if we don't have a democratic system, there is really no point in struggling further. So that is why I branched off a lot in working for democracy, and the constitutional amendment that I just mentioned, in our constitution, it started out as a secular, and then it got totally engulfed with the religion. And we knew that we didn't have any chance, but still I mobilized a lot of people. And in those days, actually, it was very difficult to say anything with the kind of militancy we have, anything about religion, but we got about 200,000 signatures saying that we want a secular constitution. And even the committee that I talked to some of the members in the committee, and they said, you know, no chance, no chance. It will take a while. the democratic rule has to stay in for a while to really even consider that. But regardless of the fact, we mobilized people and we explained people that we really need to separate the religion and the state. So we knew that we would not win, but that is the struggle that goes on. And we want a very strong democracy in Pakistan. And I continuously talk to my civil society, which still a lot of them still continue to bash. And we say, no, we have to give the strength to the parliament so that they can counter the militants and the military and whoever else that keeps coming back and taking over, turning it into a repressive regime.
Okay.
Yes, I briefly said I was born 3 years before Cultural Revolution. Actually, I was born to a party official's family. Except for the 10 years of Cultural Revolution, our family was okay. And we are privileged. But at early age, I was exposed to the reality. The reality was at great odds with what the government has taught us. I just cannot describe to you how the people of China suffered when I was little. But we were taught that we live a happy life, wonderful life, that we were the happiest people on earth. And I was exposed to the peasant's life when I was about 10 years old. There was a big flood. And I went to countryside for a few weeks to help them and returned. I just couldn't come to terms with myself and with the reality. And I don't remember for how long, I just gave up my comforters, quilt, and I slept on the concrete, on the straws, tried to, you know, to live the same life as the peasants I had seen in the countryside. So I figured out that I had some kind of a feeling that when I see other people suffer, I suffer. I just cannot take anybody, bully anybody else. So when I came to United States, I just totally exposed to freedom. And I know I enjoy freedom. When you enjoy freedom, you must speak for freedom, at least. If you enjoy dignity, you must at least speak for dignity. And I, as I said in my remarks today, you know, you take the copy of Universal Declaration to China, ask anybody, nobody would say, no, I don't want the rights listed there. So everybody wants the right, want dignity, want to be respected. That's where my confidence lies. No matter how difficult, the desire for freedom is universal because I know deep in my heart, I enjoy freedom. I enjoy being respected. I enjoy dignity. Everybody, so does everybody else. So I just cannot take the fact that the Chinese government continue to bully, you know, disadvantaged groups in China, the minorities. So you must have been aware of the crisis now unfolding in Tibet. More than 110 Tibetans have set themselves on fire protesting China's rule in Tibet. What can make a man or women to set a fire on themselves? I don't have to tell you. So this kind of suffering is unacceptable. This is unparalleled in the history of mankind. So I don't think, you know, silence is unacceptable. Of course, Chinese government repressive policy must be stopped. So, you know, maybe I say too much, but anyway, I just cannot accept the reality that some people suffer at the hands of others. When I see a person suffers, I suffer myself. That's all.
Thank you for that notion, because it dovetails what Fazio said about the importance of solidarity in the face of indignity. Marina.
Well, actually, Irvin, your question actually reminded me of another one that I'm usually asked when I speak at high schools. And there's always a kid, a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, same age I was when I went to prison, that will raise his or her hand. And this is a kid that was fiddling with his iPhone and I started talking. And halfway through the talk, I can see that they're glued. They're hanging on every word. And then they ask, but don't you regret any of the stuff you did? You know, the issue of regret. Do you regret standing up for what was right when you were 14 or 15, considering that now you know the dear price, the huge price that you have paid, that it's difficult to even put into words how big these prices that we pay are? And the first time I was asking this question, I really had to think. And I realized that if I look at all of my life as a whole, there is only one thing I can honestly and with confidence say that I am proud of. And that is when I stood up for what was right at the age of 14 without any regard for consequences. In my 14-year-old head, consequence had no meaning. And that is the only point in my life when I actually did something that made a big difference. And I think that the moral of the story that, you know, that when I look at my life, I come back to is that I eventually realized after, you know, I lost many of my friends. And as I said, you're buried in mass graves. They didn't choose that for themselves. But I am making choices because I'm alive. And every choice that I make has the potential to be either right or wrong. So today, with every choice that I make, I try to be aware of the right or wrong element and remind myself that every choice that I make can have severe consequences on my person, but at the same time, I'm aware that many have died, but I'm here. So again, it takes me to this moral of the story to me, that is that silence is a weapon of mass destruction. And I do not have to do anything with it because I know that it has taken millions of lives and it will continue to take more unless I stand in the way.
I think you'll all agree with me that what you hear here is the power of the human spirit. And just like I said about my book, no one can take the power from you. No one can kill your spirit. And if we all believe in this, believe that we have something that lies within us that no one can touch, that's the day we start living, not surviving. Thank you.
I just want to say before I conclude it for all of us that I was thinking of lessons for myself or for us here in Canada, because we've gone, you know, to other parts of the world. And the thing that kept coming back to me, because we were dealing a lot with struggling for human dignity in general and against gender-based violence in particular, was the plight of Aboriginal women here in Canada as part of the larger plight of the Aboriginal people as a whole. Now, recently we had a hearing in parliamentary debate. You know, there's been over the last several decades some 600 Aboriginal women who've been murdered or disappeared. If we translated those percentages into white people, it would be 20,000 women that have been murdered and disappeared. And I suspect there would be an outcry if that were the case, not only at the horror of the criminality, but at the indifference that accompanies it. And so I think you've all taught us some important lessons this evening. The authenticity with which you've all spoken, the feelings with which you conveyed those lessons, the importance of the struggle for human dignity and against indignity, the struggle for democracy and against those who would seek to silence us. I think those are universal lessons that can empower each of us, because that exercise of solidarity, where we understand and connect with the suffering of others and seek to do something about it and seek to make this world, as Gandhi once put it, have a touch of healing for an embittered world and make it a place where there will be less people that are the victims of such indignities, as we join in solidarity and common cause for the struggle for human rights and human dignity. Thank you all. You've made this a wonderful opening for this conference.
You might just want to perhaps step down, because we have, we're going to show the very short video, which is just about a 4 or 5 minute video on democracy. And I want to invite, and then we have to close things up, the final musical interlude. So I'd please invite Mr. Teddy Rouge, who is co-founder of the Project Diaspora, an online platform and blog for mobilizing and engaging members of the African diaspora. And he's also a consultant with the World Bank and has worked in numerous social enterprise and economic initiatives, having growing in Uganda, and also grew up in both Uganda and the United States. He's also been the facilitator this week for the Young Leaders Forum and has been working and will introduce the project of the What Democracy Means to Me video. So thank you.
Thank you very much. In his book, The Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell explored the secret to success of Silicon Valley's tech titans. In his explorations, he discovered that roughly all of them had put in about 10,000 hours worth of work. He also discovered that some of that success was really a lot of hard work and just luck. If that formula was to be applied to the struggle for human rights, ladies and gentlemen, the Ekenberg Fellows earned about 1,500 of those hours in the 6 months preceding this weekend. 500 of those were a combined travel time for them to get here. And for me as a facilitator, I earned a degree, actually, in facilitating all the conversations that went on this week, as well as all the interaction that happened in the past 6 months before they got here. It is my hope that the hours that were earned during those conversations, before you even met, will earn you the right to be change makers in the struggle for human rights and democracy around the world. I won't speak too much for them. I'll let them speak for themselves. We put together a small video on what the Ekenberg Fellowship is, and to also introduce you to the fellows themselves.
We face the future with confidence. We do so because, despite the difficulties and the tension that confront us, there is in all of us the capacity to touch one another's hearts across oceans and continents.
My name is Penny Eckenberg. I am married to Gordon Eckenberg, who co-founded the Global Conference on Human Rights here at McGill University. And I believe it's important to have a human rights conference for young leaders so that they can empower one another, help each other in their countries of origin, teach others what they've learned at these conferences, and spread the word of human rights throughout the world. The dream was my husband's. He always wanted to host a series of human rights conferences. It was particularly important to him that they bridge the gap between academia and Main Street. And that was to underline the importance of human rights to everyday people.
Being here is extremely exciting. I'm looking for practical ways to develop human rights awareness in my country without getting into legal trouble, and I'm sure the forum will help me accomplish that.
This conference is different in terms of the technology that's been used. In the previous two conferences, technology certainly played a role. In this one, it is much more predominant, and that is because the young leaders have been engaged for 6 months before even coming to Montreal. And they got here, they knew one another, they've already discussed different aspects of the conference, things that they're going to be working on, and it's been a very important part of the young leaders.
My favorite pre-conference activity was to engage with the other young leaders on various topics as part of the Facebook blog.
The blogs were really, you know, rich in terms of perspectives from the world over and the different questions about democracy, human rights, freedom that have been raised there. So that discussion is really fruitful and insightful, and I'm enjoying that a lot.
One of the most interesting blog posts for me was Claire's blog post on refugee issues and international relations, because I work on humanitarian issues back home, and it was good to have an international perspective on how those issues play out.
My blog post was about the elections that were taking place in Kenya on March 4th, and the fact that the Christian groups and civil society were a bit silenced or were not willing to voice their opinions in terms of rights that were not being observed for people like the prisoners who are not allowed to register to be voters.
I'm talking more about the exclusion of the Muslim immigrant in Burma, and then how I'm talking about how the politicians and the human rights activists silence over the racist issue and the exclusion of the ethnic minority in Burma.
I was talking about a paradox between having an underdeveloped political system and a very politicized population.
And we had several conversations over Skype in order to plan our presentation, and I got to learn a lot about my colleagues through those conversations, so it was really fascinating.
It's incredibly exciting to be part of those discussions and to see the energy and enthusiasm with which they dialogue with one another. They came here knowing what was expected of them. They're prepared. They're eager to share information with each other, to know each other better. And I feel that there is going to be a continuum of dialogue between them long after the conference is over. And it's a very hopeful, exciting takeaway from this for Gordon and I.
Past ways of doing things. The state of the world now, you know, it shows that old ways of thinking aren't working. So we need to inject youth, we need to inject vibrancy, we need energy, we need young people who can dispense with the old ways of thinking and bring new ways of thinking so that we can cure some of the world's pressing problems.
That was wonderful, and introduces you to the young leaders who are here. And thank you to the producers of the video on very pulled together in very small amount of time. So I know it's been a long evening, but we do have two more. We have our musicians who are going to play one more song, and then I want to turn it over to my honorary co-chair, Raymond Chrétien, to say a final word of thank you and to close this evening's session. So first our musicians and then my co-chair. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Merci beaucoup. C'est super. Thank you. And now I'd like to invite Maître Raymond Chrétien, honorary co-chair of the conference, to say our final words this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Colleen. I'll be very brief since it's already very late. I have prepared some comments. I will not use them. I guess I'll keep them for the sessions tomorrow and the day after. But I'd like to certainly thank not only McGill, of course, but my good friend Gordon Eckenberg and his wife Penny. They have made me a great honor in asking me to share this stage with Erwin Cutler, one of the great defenders, proponents of human rights on our planet. So it was I'm very grateful, Gordon, that you have thought of me for this role. I remember when, as two young men in 1964, we were roaming the streets or the villages of Algeria, and then later on in southern Spain, just the two of us, young men, ambitious, sharing our views about the situation in Canada, the situation in the world, really wanting to make a difference in the world. And I must tell you, after all those years, 45 years, Gordon, with with your vision and your dynamism in carrying out the organization of those conferences, you are indeed making a big difference. Thank you very much. Erwin. We have heard great testimonies, human testimonies this afternoon about human tragedies. All kinds of examples came to my mind. I'll use them tomorrow in a session on foreign policy, democracy, and human rights. I was very happy that you mentioned the situation here in Canada about First Nations. Indeed, Canada is not perfect. And let me tell you, in the management of our own foreign policy, quite often over the years I've witnessed situations where phase between our hard economic interest and human rights in the countries with which Canada is dealing, hard economic interests usually win the day. So we will have an opportunity to talk about that tomorrow. Thank you to all the young leaders, all of you students who came to participate this evening to make your voice heard, and for your interest in protecting and promoting human rights around the world. May your work serve to inspire others and provide hope to those in need. Merci beaucoup. Bonsoir.